Evening, everybody, and welcome to the Joint Committee on Public Safety. It's Wednesday, March 27th, and 6:15 right now. That's PM for you. Hey, members, I just want to go over a couple things for tonight. We've got invited testimony, and what our main focus is going to be talking about reinvestment priority is outlined by the commission that we came up with. And the four identified areas that we'd been talking about was specialty courts, community corrections, victim services, and law enforcement training were the four things that we'd come up with. So with that, if we could stay focused with our questions from that tonight, I'd appreciate that. Okay, and our first, for victim services reinvestment priorities.
Good
our
recovery
own
there.
Attorney General, Ellen Rosenblum. Thank you.
Oh, we're getting giddy.
Yes, we are.
We're just having fun tonight.
I am happy to engage in some fun with you, even though it's a very serious topic here this evening. Thank you so much, and good evening. Co-chairs Olson, Garrett, Przanski, Winters, and members of the committee. My name's Ellen Rosenblum. I'm the Oregon Attorney General. I want to thank you for the important work that you're doing to find ways to save money while ensuring our citizens are safe, offenders are held accountable, and victims of crime receive the care and services they need. Throughout my career, I've worked within the criminal justice system in various roles. As a brand new lawyer, I took court appointments in juvenile and adult criminal court back when Lane County didn't yet have a public defender. I represented children and their parents in the child protective system, which included many cases involving domestic violence. As a state trial and appellate judge for 22 years, I saw it all. I presided over cases from small claims in traffic court to family law, protective orders, to major criminal trials, including capital murder. I have sentenced, in that capacity, thousands of defendants and upheld and occasionally reversed thousands of convictions. I also come from a long history of looking at these issues at the policy level, having served on three different governor's task forces on public safety, and having also served what sometimes felt like a life sentence as the chair of the Governor's Advisory Committee on Corrections Population Forecasting from the early 90s until 2005. To put this in a bit of perspective, back in the 1980s, I was a member of the Governor's Blue Ribbon Task Force on Corrections Planning that discussed many of the same kinds of things that are on the table today. Prison expansion, intermediate sanctions, giving local governments the opportunity for local control over low-level felony offenders with sentences of less than a year, those were some of the issues that were on the table back then. But there were also some differences. We worried then about the prediction of 8,000 prison beds, only about 5,000 of which existed at the time. This was the late 80s. The idea that policy decisions could be based upon evidence-based research as to what works and what doesn't was barely discussed. Now, of course, that research helps guide us in these efforts to make our state safer, hold offenders accountable, and control corrections costs. I am committed, as your new Attorney General, to working together to take a hard look at how we're spending our scarce public safety dollars and to focus more on crime prevention, including redirecting savings from prison growth into local public safety, in particular, victim services, reentry programs, and substance abuse treatment. But tonight I want to focus on supporting victims' services. Why? Because not only are we required by statute and the Oregon Constitution to support and uphold an extensive list of victims' rights, but it saves lives, protects children, and it has the added key feature that it helps stop the vicious cycle of crime. Certainly one of the most poignant examples of the need for reinvestment of our corrections dollars is our failure to serve our communities when it comes to protection from domestic violence. As we know, family relationships that are safe and healthy provide an important foundation for success in life. Being safe and supported at home enables children to succeed in school, parents to excel in their careers, and communities to prosper and thrive. Unfortunately, not every family relationship is safe and healthy. Many are fraught with fear of physical violence, psychological and financial abuse, and a feeling of instability. Thankfully, Oregon has a strong network of victim services that help people experiencing violence find safety and rebuild their lives. I'm honored to be here today to talk about the primary avenues in Oregon where victims receive professional assistance: district attorney-based victims assistance programs, child abuse multidisciplinary intervention programs, and community-based, nonprofit, domestic and sexual violence services programs. These three types of victim services have distinct yet complementary purposes. Together, they weave a safety net that enables individual victims, families, and communities to become stronger. I was pleased to highlight the importance of victim services and the critical contribution of victim service professionals last year as part of the work of the Public Safety Commission. In October, I hosted two roundtable discussions with crime victims, survivors, and victim advocates to establish priorities for crime victims and those who serve them. 35 survivors and advocates from across the state attended these roundtable discussions, representing the diversity of victims' needs and experience. One of the roundtable discussions was held in Klamath Falls, so we could identify concerns of victims and advocates in rural, remote, and tribal jurisdictions. Between the two roundtable discussions, 13 priorities were identified to improve victims' rights and services in Oregon. And of these priorities, the Commission identified three that rose to the top: increased funding for domestic and sexual violence services, increased funding for system-based victim services programs, and increased funding for child abuse intervention centers. I agree with these priorities, and I'm honored to talk with you a bit about them today. So let me start with the ODSVS, the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund. More than 85,000 Oregon women report that they have been physically or sexually abused by an intimate partner in the last 4 years. In 2011, domestic violence programs responded to more than 175,000 calls for help. Last year, more than 20,600 requests for emergency shelter went unmet. And of those that were in a shelter, 44% were under the age of 18. Oregon's network of domestic and sexual violence services saves lives, literally. These services provide victims with the tools necessary to become survivors: safe shelter, safety planning, counseling, medical accompaniment, and legal advocacy. And research shows that these services work. A report from the Johns Hopkins University revealed that accessing domestic violence services reduced reassault by up to 70%. A recent study done with one of the domestic violence programs in Portland, BOA Home Free, also showed that women and children were safer in the 18 months after accessing services. Prior to receiving services, 85% of women were in extreme or severe danger based on the danger assessment scale. Following domestic violence services, only 9.5% of women reported extreme or severe danger. Accessing shelter and support services was even more effective than intervention by law enforcement or the courts. Providing access to domestic and sexual violence services does more than just remove a barrier to physical safety from an individual person or family. It removes barriers to the overall health and well-being of our communities. Access to victim services reduces homelessness, saves millions in medical costs, increases the effectiveness of substance abuse programs, helps children succeed in schools, and adults stay in jobs. And perhaps most critical to our work here, it cuts down on crime by breaking cycles of violence. These life-saving services are vital to the well-being of every Oregon community, yet they are so underfunded that over 20,000 requests for shelter from violence couldn't be met last year. That's more than two unmet requests every hour of every day of the entire year. About half of these requests came from victims who were also seeking safety for their children. Fatalities related to intimate partner violence have skyrocketed in the past 4 years, with over 150 deaths occurring in that period out of the 200 or so in the past decade, and at least 10 of these were children. When shelters are full and that month's supply of motel vouchers have run out, domestic and sexual violence service providers get creative and do all they can to help the victim develop a plan to stay safe. For some women and children in the Portland metro region, that may mean riding the MAX line all night or sleeping at the airport. In rural areas, the safest option may be for a victim to sleep in her car or camp at the beach or in the woods with her children. Some programs report providing information as to the safest bridge to sleep under to abused moms and their children, since there was nowhere else for them to refer them to. We can only guess how many of the 20,000-plus unmet requests for shelter left victims with no choice but to return to an unstable, potentially violent home. It can be easier to find grant funds for specific programs and training, like rural services or cultural competency, but flexible funds for basic services remain elusive. Programs across the state are closing core service programs, like walk-in crisis centers, or closing down for certain days of the week altogether. We need to bolster these programs, not reduce or shut them down when we know they work as lifelines to thousands of victims and potential victims of crime. I want to talk for a moment about the District Attorney-based Victims Assistance Programs, the DAVAPs as they are called. They are located in all 36 District Attorney offices across the state, and they help crime victims navigate the criminal justice system and access victims' rights. Since 2008, the rights afforded to victims have increased, while the funding for the DAVAPs has decreased. The funds allocated to DAVAPs were reduced by $800,000, an 18% decrease between the 2007 to 2009 and 2011 to 2013 biennia. DAVAPs provide assistance to victims in areas including notification of their constitutional rights, obtaining shelter, crisis counseling, domestic violence and sexual assault program referral, accompanying them to court hearings, filing DOJ compensation claims, and coordinating restitution requests. In 1 year, each DAVAP in Oregon provided an average of over 10,000 services, serving on average 1,000 victims per program. But they're strapped for resources, and I urge you to invest in these programs so no victim gets re-traumatized in the maze and the emotional turmoil of the criminal justice system. The Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Programs, the CAMI, known as the CAMI programs. CAMI provides funds to local child abuse intervention centers and child abuse multidisciplinary response teams in all 36 counties. In 2011, Oregon was home to 863,425 children. Nationally, it's estimated that 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys will be sexually abused by their 18th birthday. So the potential impact on Oregon children is significant and devastating. These centers, and I know many of you have visited them, and I have visited 3 of them since taking office, they're often located in bungalow-style houses in the community they serve. They're homey and child-centered with lots of stuffed animals, staffed by caring adults who serve as intake and forensic interviewers, pediatric physicians, social workers, and volunteers who do their best to give children suspected of having been abused a place to feel comfortable and safe. Despite the proliferation in reported child abuse, CAMI's funding has been reduced by 7% since 2007. CAMI has absorbed funding reductions over the past 2 biennia while experiencing increased demand for child abuse intervention. If the funding for CAMI is not increased, Oregon can expect to see devastating results: increased delays in response to abuse allegations, increased delays in the time it takes for children to be assessed, reduced quality of the assessments due to less well-trained forensic investigators, loss of services if centers close, and most importantly, increased risk to vulnerable children because it will be harder to hold offenders accountable. So, to sum up, protecting crime victims is not a passing fad at the Oregon Department of Justice. It's part of our central mission. As I said in the beginning of this presentation, a strong, vital victim services program saves lives, protects children, and helps end domestic violence. It helps stop crime. Certainly, there could be no more important or noble use for a public safety dividend than steering some of that money to these ends. So I thank you very much for allowing me the honor of appearing before you this evening.
Questions? Wow. Well, thank you. Well, very kind of you.
Thank you, Coach Harrelson, and all of you for having me.
Okay, next panel that we have is Kevin Campbell, Chief John Tigg, and retired Chief Steve Weininger.
Thank you. Good evening, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police tonight. We're going to try to be brief because I know everybody's had a long day. Tonight, you may wonder how we follow issues as important as victims' issues with a discussion of training. And the reality is they fit very nicely together. Both of these programs are key priorities that are actually listed in statute under the criminal fines and assessments accounts. And so we feel very comfortable both supporting those CAMU programs and talking about the training program we'd like to introduce you to tonight. Tonight, I'd like to talk about an opportunity and an obstacle within the public safety training arena. Training doesn't sound very sexy, but for those of us who are involved in the public safety arena, training makes a huge difference in terms of downstream impacts. Today, the obstacle is that the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training over the last couple bienniums has lost over 40 positions for a very small agency. They are the statewide organization that provides all training to public safety entities. And for Chief Teague and Chief Weiniger, the programs that most impact us tonight relate to public safety leadership training. That program at DPSST was completely cut. And the regional training program that allows training to be given to agencies around the state has been drastically reduced from 9 positions down to 2. So our obstacle right now is that as we look at the public safety system and we consider it a system that includes several system critical parts, public safety training is one of them. And when public safety training is lacking or diminished, the results in terms of agency health are seen, and the product as it is felt by the public is greatly impacted as well. So what's the opportunity tonight? This morning in Senate Judiciary, we heard Senate Bill 481, which was passed out of committee into Ways and Means. It creates the potential for creating a Center for Leadership Excellence at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. The reason this is possible in Oregon is that the federal government and others on the federal level are trying to find a state that could be an ideal pilot for evidence-based leadership training. Why are we attractive as a state? I think it's because in 2005, as we were deciding what to do with our public safety training in Oregon, we decided against a regional training program that would have required officers to go to one of a number of regional training facilities around the state, and we created a single core academy. That single core academy now, because it certifies every officer and trains every officer, is an ideal statewide pilot for evidence-based leadership training. And we'd love to see that happen in Oregon. What's the challenge and why are we bringing it to your discussion tonight in terms of reinvestment? They have told us that they cannot invest in a state that has divested themselves from leadership training. If we can restore our commitment to leadership training, they believe they can fund this complete center for leadership excellence federally, and one is required to achieve the other, and that's why we're here tonight. We feel like the system is currently out of balance. Plus, we think we have a unique opportunity if we can find a way to restore some of that leadership and regional training. So what I'd like to do now is turn it over to Chief John Teague, the police chief from the Dallas Police Department. He can give you a little more detail about what that center might entail.
Thank you, co-chairs and committee members. Thank you for hearing our testimony today. My name is John Teague. I'm the chief of police in Dallas. Thank you for hearing our testimony regarding excellence in policing. The Harvard Kennedy School, in its publication, New Perspectives in Policing, observes that across the United States, police organizations are striving for a new professionalism. Driving that professionalism is a renewed interest in accountability, legitimacy, and innovation. And as law enforcement agencies move closer towards the ideals present within these interests, a national coherence is beginning to develop. Jim Bierman, the president of the Police Foundation, an organization that pioneered research in policing, spoke to these combined judiciary committees last year. In that discussion of evidence-based policing, he said that Oregon is uniquely positioned to be a forerunner of policing excellence. As a consequence, he, the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, and law enforcement executives collaborated to leverage Oregon's unique positioning into the Oregon Center for Policing Excellence, ensuring that Oregon is a part of, if not a leader in, the new police professionalism, and in the process that Oregon reduces crime and the costs of crime. The 2011 Commission on Public Safety report to the governor states that Oregon can increase public safety at less cost by investing in more cost-effective programs for the purposes of reducing recidivism and preventing future crime and victimization. The report states that there have been hundreds of rigorous studies of criminal justice programs, and we now have a much richer knowledge of what works and what doesn't. This is true, but that knowledge isn't being translated to the small agency, practitioners, your local police chiefs and sheriffs, and the peace officers who work for them. This lack of translation from academia to practitioners is a very real problem. Bierman recounted the lack of practitioner journals that put academic language into language usable by law enforcement. Anthony Braga, a widely published criminologist writing for Translational Criminology, answers that academics must establish relationships with agencies and conduct research from within them, something that isn't going to happen in most small or otherwise resource-strapped police agencies. Cynthia Lum, another criminologist and the developer of the evidence-based policing matrix, notes that there is little indication that most American police leaders and their agencies systematically or regularly use tactics that are evidence-based. She also notes that peace officers are not using evidence-based approaches, not because they consciously believe their experience is more worthwhile. Rather, they use their experience because the police organizations do not provide them with any alternative worldview, alternative strategies, or alternative tools with which to think about and combat crime. Once established, the Oregon Center for Policing Excellence will bridge that gap. The Oregon Center is such a progressive idea that the Police Foundation wants to fund much of its activity as a model for other states. However, the Police Foundation cannot fund the fundamental executive and supervisor level training and education necessary. That basic education, they say, is a state and local responsibility. There's some amended language in Senate Bill 481 establishing that DPSST will provide that training and education. In the last quarter of the last century, it was assumed that the police could do little to influence crime other than to solve individual crimes. Up until that time, there was very little scientific research of policing, research into what peace officers do and the effects of their activities. But research since then has demonstrated that the police can have a profound effect. And today, there is so much research that scholars and police find it difficult to keep up, let alone to evaluate its qualitative merits and practical utility. Today, the evidence is in. How police officers are how police officers are deployed and how they perform their jobs can measurably affect their efficiency and can measurably prevent crimes from happening. Presently, Oregon has no system for gathering, translating, and distributing criminological research to its law enforcement agencies. Oregon peace officers want to know what the best practices are, and they want to know how to use them. The Oregon Center for Policing Excellence will provide that, and it will provide better policing, reduced costs, and fewer lives affected by victimization and incarceration. Thank you.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Steve Weiniger, and I'm here representing the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. I come with kind of a unique background in that I am a retired police chief, but I'm also an academic with a doctorate in public administration and policy. So I've got my feet in both of those worlds. And we think that the Oregon Center for Policing Excellence could be the vehicle that can bridge those two worlds and get that research out to the practitioners, even in the small communities like Dallas, the small agencies, and in turn also then provide information for the researchers that, they can use to further their knowledge and our knowledge as far as what works. So.
Questions?
We asked ours this morning.
And then beat him up this morning?
I'm sorry you had to listen to it twice.
Okay.
And then I understand I get to ask questions tomorrow.
Do you want to ask them now?
I'll wait because tomorrow they're going to be in subcommittee, as I understand tomorrow.
Okay, so you're going to be patient.
Yes, co-chairs, we wish to testify in every committee.
Call it the four-mill deal.
All right, well, hey, thank you very much. Okay, then their next panel, Craig Prinz, Jim Bernard, Clackamas County Commissioner, and Jay Dixon, Benton County Commissioner.
Good
co-chairs and members of the committee. I'm Clackamas County Commissioner Jim Bernard. And as you know, in Clackamas County, we all agree on everything.
Actually, Commissioner, I see Chris Hoy shaking his head back there. Yeah,
so. Well, you know, I've served as a county commissioner for Clackamas County. I'm on my fifth year. I served as mayor of Milwaukee for 8 years. And many years ago, I fought the opening of Clackamas County's community correction facility in the city of Milwaukee. Now on the other side, I learned that we're just doing a really fantastic job. Matter of fact, the better job we do, the less money we get. And that's the problem. House Bill 3194 gives us some incentive to do a better job. How that's going to work is that we're going to, get about $32 million to split among the many counties, and we're going to spend that money through the commission in a way that we think will help promote public safety. That could be in community corrections, or that could be in the DA's office or in the sheriff's department. But we have the ability to, improve our system and be incentivized for doing it rather than being punished for doing a great job. Our residential facility in Milwaukee does outstanding work. No one who gets out of prison and comes to Clackamas County ends up on the street. When they get out, they have a place to go. And Clackamas County is committed to making sure those people have a transitional housing, a place to begin their lives. We also have great partnerships with our Community Solutions Department, making sure those people know how to fill out a resume, how to get a job. And that's what keeps them out of our jails. I'm also the co-chair of a public safety committee, and I serve as on the Community Corrections Commission. And we've been working really hard to turn things around. And thanks to Chris Hoy and his hard work, we've been very successful in doing that. Today we had about 40 people either on the phone or in a meeting talking about House Bill 3194 and what it means to them, and we don't all agree. But I think we do all agree that we need more money to provide the services that are necessary to keep people out of jail and out of prison. And we can't do that without your help. And one thing that I think is really important, that reducing a sentence from 19 to 24 months, that person's going to get out of jail anyways. 97% of those people do. A couple more months in jail is not going to make them a better citizen, but a few months in community corrections can. And so we're committed to doing that. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Craig Prinz. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. Prior to that, I was a DA, a Deputy DA in Multnomah County, and I was counsel for the Judiciary Committee, and then was the Deputy Director at the Police Academy before having this position. Thank you for letting me go through some of the work. I think Andra handed out a two-colored sheet. It's my job to kind of report back from the work group that's been working from the governor's budget.
Craig, we do not have it hard copies. It's on OLIS.
Okay.
So we're not going to be able to follow.
Okay. Well, I'll walk through it, and then we'll see. My apologies, and maybe we can get a hard copy for you.
Okay.
As you know, 3194 is really the governor's, the embodiment of the governor's plan from the Commission on Public Safety to, hold offenders accountable and identify fiscally responsible and sustainable policies and practices to increase public safety. And It's always been a blend of reinvestment and sentencing to balance our public safety system, to avoid 2,000 more prison beds being needed over the next 10 years, and to really invest that savings into the local system where we can, we think, reduce recidivism and invest in the kind of programs that Attorney General Rosenblum spoke to. So in the governor's budget, we started with that goal in the governor's budget. And as you know, the governor's budget was built around having the prison control that is embodied in 3194. And it then had a $32 million, we called it an incentive pot, basically, to have some of that reinvestment now in the short term. And so what we've done then is had a state and county partnership and work group to really figure out the best way to equitably distribute that money throughout the state and to make sure that we're cognizant of what the, you know, we really believe that the local level is where the best decisions happen in public safety, and we wanted to be cognizant of how different every county is and cognizant of rural and urban counties and all those things. So we had a work group that the commissioners were part of, Sheriff Myers and Sheriff Simpson were a part of, Scott Taylor, Mark Royal, Chris Hoy came, several of the county community corrections folks, and then Steve Marks and myself and folks from the Department of Corrections. So it really was a county-state partnership. And I just, when you get the spreadsheet, I'm going to walk through basically what our work group proposes to do with the $32 million. The governor's budget was, when it came out, we looked at the grant in aid, and the community corrections directors looked at the grant in aid for the community corrections budgets. And Senator Winters, I know that this will be back again in Ways and Means, I think, next week. I don't know if it's this week or next week. But when the directors looked at that, one of the clear messages that came from the counties is we can't talk about incentives and incentivizing good performance until we really have stable baseline funding for our community corrections. And so what we looked at is also, especially in the rural counties, it really doesn't make sense to try to do enter into a state-county agreement where you would be looking at the number of prison months imposed and trying to set targets off of that until we really came to grips with the level of cuts that have happened over the last few biennia. So basically what we did is we took the $32 million, and I think there was consensus that we should use a portion of that, and that would be about $18.4 million, and that would go directly into the grant in aid to the counties so that the counties would have that as the basis to then think about incentives. So let me see if... Andrew, can I have a copy of that to make sure I'm working from the same sheet?
Oh, good.
I think so.
Thank you. Okay, it's just not color. Okay. So you can see on the ledger you've got before you, basically you look at the counties, and on the left side of the ledger in the lighter gray is basically what the governor's budget would have proposed would basically have been a 7.9% increase in the grant in aid from where it was in 11-13. And it was loud and clear that that was not enough to do evidence-based programs to reduce recidivism. So then the next column that says reinvestment grant in aid to counties, that would be the $18.4 million investment into the formula that goes directly to community corrections. So once we made that investment, then we got to talk about the incentive payment. And the incentive payment is the next one where it says reinvestment incentive grant. That would be an investment of $13.6 million across the state. You can see what each county would be looking at in that column. That would go directly, as the commissioner said, to the county commissioner to invest where it makes sense to invest in public safety services in that county. And we really trust that that partnership's going to work, and the local decisions will get us the best return on investment in that county. Because I think the Clackamas County example that Chris and the commissioner mentioned, with the, for example, the halfway house that they had to close down, they know that type of thing better than someone could at the state level. So that is the $13.6 million that 3194 then allows the grant in aid, and then allows counties to voluntarily choose to enter into an incentive plan. And the incentive plan is that the counties would have a target of how many months of prison they would impose. We spent a lot of time on how to make that an equitable target. We tried to understand counties that, every county is different. What we came up with is we looked at recent use of prisons in the last 2 years, how many months of prison had been imposed in that county in the last 2 years. We looked at the historical use of prison in that county, and we set a target of a reduction of that of 6%, so using 94% of that. And we explained that House Bill 3194 really gets that work done for the county. The sentencing changes that you all are looking at with the Measure 57 change that the commissioner spoke to, the transition leave, the earned time, those sentencing changes will really do the work for the county. And this just to make sure that the incentive is that the county-state partnership works in conjunction, that we work together and have a long-term solution. And so then the next column over shows just the if you take that $32 million and you add it to the governor's balanced budget, you see the governor's balanced budget plus that total reinvestment for the counties that would get the grant in aid and enter into those agreements. So you can see that from the 11-13 investment, this is a 25% increase. And you can see that for each county, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Good. Okay, Mr. Hicks. Thank you, Mr. Chair. How can counties, how is the 6% reduction calculated? Does it have to do particularly with whether counties are sending fewer inmates into the prison system, or that they're sending them for shorter sentences, or is it the county's discretion? How is that calculated?
A great point, Co-Chair and Representative Hicks. Representative Hicks, I know that you and I, we were deputy DAs, and you think of this at a granular level, which I appreciate. And so to answer, I think 3194, as you know, will make a lot of this possible. So like a 90-day transition leave, for example, if Abe Huntley is going to take a guy from prison 90 days early, you'd get credit for that 90 days. If the guy earns his earned time, he'd get that. If a judge wanted to divert a Measure 57 eligible property offender to a drug court, all of those things would be savings that would count to getting your 6% reduction. To get, to really get that marriage, if you will, of the sentencing and the, I would call it the making sure that the counties are aware and tracking this, and I feel like it's a really different way from when we would have looked at this in the past. So it really counts months imposed over the next biennium, and we'd like to have a six-year agreement, to have a long-term agreement to make sure this is not something that we just do for 2 years. And so with the sentencing changes in 3194 and that cognizance of this, we would just be tracking months imposed, and that could be done, in any way that the county sees appropriate.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Has the discussion evolved to the point where we're even contemplating dollar amounts or ranges of dollar amounts over the course of 6 years?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, it has. We've just started that part of the conversation. Okay. Steve's here from the governor's.
I'll put him on the spot.
The governor's folks. But yes, we just started talking about the next bienniums and making sure this is a long-term sustainable plan. And so the commissioners spoke with Steve and today about that. We first wanted to get this in front of everyone. It was a lot of work to first get, it's always hard to figure out an equitable way to split up the first part, but that I think is the next part of the conversation to make sure that this is a long-term investment that makes sense for all of us so that we can balance this system and make sure we're doing everything we can to hold offenders accountable and to promote public safety.
Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With respect to the state-county partnership, I guess I'm curious, where does the city fall in line here? I'm thinking about, you know, the Gresham Police Department. They are understaffed right now and doing a phenomenal job, but certainly they'd like to see a part of this. And then beyond that, I'm also trying not to get too far in front of this thing because I have yet to realize what we have to do to get these dollars. Mm-hmm. And I'm very cautious about how we proceed or get too excited about spending money that we don't have yet and we have to take actions to get.
Chair, Representative Matthews, great point. I mean, we wanted to first, it's a lot of work just to figure out, you know, we had the governor's budget. We understand that there's a long road between now and actually getting that $32 million investment. We just wanted to make sure that we all had an understanding of how it would be distributed. As far as Gresham, I know exactly what you're talking about. I've looked at the Rockwood neighborhood and looked at Gresham, and I've looked at the violent crime rates of Gresham. This is this portion. The commissioners could certainly invest in something in the city, but it would really be a local decision. The contract would be an agreement between the county commissioners and the state. That is going to be a local control decision where the county would have to make a decision if it made sense, for example, to enter into something with a city program that they felt was the wisest investment, or if it's DA services for a drug court, or if it's victim services. It's really going to be a local decision for the counties.
Thank you.
Representative.
Thank you for indulging me again, Mr. Chair. Have we started vetting language around the parameters, if you will, regarding how the commissioners may, at their discretion, use the money within the justice system? Is there language that's being contemplated yet?
Co-Chair, Representative Hicks, we've kept it very broad that it has to be on public safety services.
Okay.
My agency administers the justice assistance grants. I don't know, you're familiar with that. Very broad. That's really about is the level of control we want to have. We want to have it be a local investment in public safety.
Okay. Well, Commissioner Dixon, sir.
Representative Olson, who happens to be one of my representatives. Co-chairs and members of the committee, thank you for giving us time to talk with you this evening. I am Benton County Commissioner Jay Dixon. I'm co-chair of AOC's Public Safety Committee. Also serve on the Community Corrections Commission for the state of Oregon. And I'm a member of the Community Corrections Funding Work Group that's taken the $32 million and tried to figure out how to equitably distribute it so that everybody wins. I believe in community corrections. I think it's less expensive than treating these people at the state level, and I think it's more effective. So I support the Community Corrections Incentive Measure and Senate Bill 3194. Looking at the proposed distribution, our county would receive an additional $374,000 in the first biennium. That would buy a couple of sheriff's deputies. It would buy a couple of probation officers. It would buy a couple of juvenile counselors. It would buy a number of different things, or it might provide treatment for the mentally ill who are in the jail system. And while those things would be a great benefit, the other benefit is we're reducing the prison population and we're reducing the expense of the prison population. So I clearly support this measure and hope that you will too. Thank you.
Questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Ken, our last panel tonight deals with Measure 11 modification. And I see all three of you are sitting back there together, Rod Underhill, Larry Matizar, and Judge Darrell Larson. You guys didn't compare notes, did you, or anything like that while you were back there?
I was getting tips from them.
Right.
This seems appropriate, the judge in, the, in between the two.
Yeah.
They've got me right where they want me. This is nothing new.
It's typical refereeing.
Except one has a blue tie.
Yeah, we're really lawyered up tonight. We got pinstripe suits on.
Now, one thing that we didn't do is agree upon who is going to go first, second, or third. So does anybody have a choice, or do you have an order that you'd like?
I think Larry's going first, second, and third.
Right. Rob, why don't you go ahead and start then?
All right, then I will. Because I spoke up, I'm sure. Well, first of all, thank you very much. My name is Rod Underhill. Co-chairs Olson and Garrett, Przanski and Winters, again, thank you very much, and members of the committee. As people have introduced themselves, they've taken a moment to talk about their professional backgrounds. I'm going to deviate, step outside that box for a minute, because most of you don't know me, and I just want to take a moment to tell you about more than my profession, who shapes my life, and those are my family members. So I am a father of three young children, 9, 14, and 21, not so young, I suppose, for her especially. My wife, Dana, is a lawyer in Portland. She works for an ethics-based law firm. She does employment law. I met her when she worked for the Public Defender's Office in Multnomah County, and we began dating then. Many people who know her, and there are several in the room that know Dana, they would tell you that she is the brains of the family, and I don't necessarily disagree, except when it comes to the topic of public safety, and that's what I want to spend some time talking, obviously, with you about. But another aspect that has shaped me as a person is that I have one brother, and my brother was relatively recently in my life released from a 5-year prison term. He spent 4 years in prison of that 5-year term, having recently been released for drug trafficking. He spent a lifetime of addiction his entire adult life. He's 1 year younger than me. He's clean and sober now. So what that tells me, and I like to tell you, is I am a firm believer in second chances, third chances, and when it comes to my brother, 100 chances, frankly. Now, that being the case, I'm also a member of our large community, the community of citizens in the state of Oregon. And as I weave into my professional life and my career as a prosecutor, I have a social contract. I have a social contract to all of you, all of the people sitting behind me, and the rest of us. And that social contract is kind of simple, and it's that we live our lives happy and free of violence and free of crime. Obtaining that and meeting that social contract is challenging and difficult. My career as a prosecutor, I touched on it for a moment, 25 years. I'm recently elected. I've been in office about 4 months. But I've spent my entire 25 years as a prosecutor. 10 of those years, I prosecuted nothing but domestic violence crimes, child abuse-related crimes, gang violence for another several years. When I listened to our Attorney General Rosenblum, who I trust is, no, she left, but I'm going to say it anyway.
Oh, she's back there.
Oh, she is. Well, I'm going to... when I listened to her words, just a shout out for her pearls of wisdom relative to victim services, she is spot on in the need for investment in victim services. But I'll move on. My professional career has had me prosecuting for 20 years or so, boots on the ground, ballot measure 11 related crimes. The crimes at issue in Senate Bill 3194, sex abuse in the first degree, robbery in the second degree, assault in the second degree, I am very much familiar with. I was a prosecutor both before Measure 11, and I've been a prosecutor, of course, since Measure 11. One of the questions, and while I understand that they are but three of the 22 ballot Measure 11 listed crimes, they do make up about 36% of the prison intakes. The people that are serving prison, 36% are connected to these three offenses. And why does that make sense? And it's an interesting question. It's a question we need to drill down, because obviously the math doesn't add up when you start to look at percentages and you look at those three carrying the bulk of our prison intakes. So what do those charging instruments look like? What does a sex abuse 1 charging instrument look like? What does a robbery 2, assault 2 charging instrument look like? Well, I'll back up and I'll tell you from a general premise, we all know that in this area, ballot measure 11,
We're going to reach a resolution. It's going to be a negotiated plea in approximately 85% of those cases. So 85% or so of the time, we're going to have involved people like Mr. Matizar and myself in conjunction with meeting with judges, such as when our Attorney General was a judge in Multnomah County, we would meet with her, and we would reach a resolution on the case. Now, I know Mr. Matizar will not describe me as the best negotiator of all time, and he would be right when he says that. And the reason I bring that up is those indictments are not just alleging one count of sex abuse in the first degree, and I am so gifted in my negotiation style and skill that I've convinced Mr. Matizar or Ms. Myers, when she was a defense attorney in our jurisdiction, to plead guilty to the primary offense and do that 75 months. That's not what those indictments look like. So when I bring that up because I do not believe that we get to the savings that you think we will through this vehicle. And I want to be candid about it. And I want to go on further and explain what I'm talking about. Those indictments, so that individual, and I have with me, staff in my office ran the last 3 years of every individual who was ever charged with sex abuse in an indictment. It's a 122-page document, front and back, lots of people. What do those, and so I've taken the time, of course, to flip through them, and then I use my 20 years or so anecdotal experience as boots on the ground. Those indictments look like this. Count one, rape in the first degree. Count two, sodomy in the first degree. Count three, unlawful sexual penetration or compelling prostitution in a pimp scenario. And they'll have in there, as a count, sex abuse in the first degree. The typical negotiation in the resolution in about 85% of the cases that we resolve are going to be, your client needs to plead guilty to sex abuse in the first degree, 75 months, and I will not go to trial on the rape in the first degree, 100 months. I will not go to trial on the sodomy in the first degree. The other form of indictments are the historical but classic stepfather, multiple serial abuse of a young girl under 14 years of age. That's what sex abuse is in the first degree. That's one of the forms. So when we have a tortured young adult living in a home and abused multiple times, we're going to have maybe six counts of sex abuse in the first degree. And a negotiation style will be plead to one of those counts. Maybe we'll run another concurrent. We'll dismiss the rest. My point that I'm trying to get to is by taking out of Measure 11 sex abuse in the first degree and dropping it down to a gridlock scenario. It's a gridlock 8 right now. By doing so, you drop it down to, at least an 8i, is 16 to 18 months. I'll revisit that negotiation for a moment and hopefully make my point. When I'm in the room negotiating now with that same indictment, charging rape in the first degree, sodomy in the first degree, sex abuse in the first degree, you're not going to hear prosecutors say, we're going to go down to sex abuse in the first degree, and your client will do, whether it's 16 or 18 or 24 or 36. That gap is too vast from what the person did, rape in the first degree, 100 months. We have the ability, prosecutors are creative, so are defense attorneys with the assistance of judges. We can do, for example, attempted rape in the first degree and some collateral charges that we can get ourselves back up to that 75-month sentence that exists today. That point I hope I make, that this seems to be the wrong vehicle to accomplish the savings for which you pursue. When we look at robbery in the second degree, when we look at assault in the second degree, those indictments resemble. I won't go through the detail that I've just done, but I'll tell you that assault in the second degree, for example, that indictment looks like assault in the first degree, attempted murder. And again, we're resolving a vast majority of those cases through the negotiation. We're dismissing charges and offenses in order for that person to agree to do that 70-month assault in the second degree prison term. When or if the reduction occurs, I believe there'll be a different method to obtain the same result that we do today. or argue, well, I don't want to go into the, or arguably worse, but I think there is a possibility for that to exist sometimes. So one of the questions that we also ask ourselves, well, what about the, what about that about 15 or 20% that go to trial? You know, that falls into a different analysis. And one of the things to be aware of is that when you look at ballot measure 11 sentences, 59% have a consecutive aspect to them. 59%. So what does that tell you? That tells you, because consecutive terms are either a product of negotiation or a product of the judge choosing to impose a consecutive term, and just hearing argument from Mr. Matazar and myself and making an election. So when you know that that is the data, that is the statistic, you also know that when judges are left to their own devices following a trial, for example, in over half of the occasions, it seems, they're imposing a consecutive term. So the I want to move on for a moment and maybe finish with, because one of my jobs is to I sincerely appreciate the opportunity to come visit your house and talk to you, but my job at times is to bring you into my house and my world, and sometimes my world is a dark place. We go out to crime scenes. We see bad things and bad people. A particular situation that I want to summarize for you. It was years ago, a handful of years ago, that a partner in the office and I prosecuted a homicide case. The homicide case, from my standpoint, began for me and my involvement December 13th of 2001. When we finished that trial, I had called to the witness stand in the nearly over 2 month, close to 3 month trial, nearly 20 victims of this individual, 20 victims during the case and then during the penalty phase. Almost half of those victims were from his, when he was 15 years of age. He was known back then as the Woodlawn Park rapist. He sexually assaulted young girls as young as 9. One was 10, another was 11. A couple were 13, 14. He has sexually assaulted several young women back in 1984. He was arrested. He was prosecuted. A very wise, aggressive, appropriate, and insightful judge, Harrell, sentenced him to 20 years at, you know, back in the mid-80s. He did 2 years. He was released. Shortly after his release, he approached three more girls in 1989 with a gun. One of them he fired 3 shots at, was her testimony at trial, as he was ordering her with profanity-laced comments to get into the car. Of course, we know he was going to sexually assault her if she'd done that. She ran. He fired shots at her. He did that 2 other times that same day. He was arrested, prosecuted, and a second judge now imposed a 30-year sentence. He was released 5 years later. In 1996, mere 3 months or so after his release, he sexually assaulted a young woman, Janet Cha. Within months, he sexually assaulted another young woman. And then within a few months, another young woman. I'm going to fast forward ahead to 2001, where he murdered Melissa Bittler. Sexually assaulted and murdered her. And I prosecuted LaDon Stevens. And he is now serving life term with a 1,000-year-plus consecutive term. Now, what is that? That is belt and suspenders. Some would call it overkill. I call it, thank God we will not make a mistake and let that kind of person out again. That person, had it been Measure 11 in the mid-80s, would not have been out in 2 years. Had it been the Measure 11 in the early 90s, he would not have been out to sexually assault several other young girls. Melissa Bittler may be one of us up here, right here, behind me. At the very least, she would be celebrating probably a happy college degree in her hands and a lifetime of looking forward. We violated our social contract to her. That's why these offenses, well used by your prosecutors, well used. We are very judicious and responsible in who we choose to send to prison. When we look at that low-risk assessment that we've done, we know we're sending the right people to prison. Thank you.
I think it might be
Larry?
Need the microphone.
Co-chairs, members of the committee. I'm Larry Matisar. I'm a defense attorney in Portland, Oregon. My experience is in a wide variety of cases, but it includes some with Mr. Underhill's wife, who is definitely the brains in the family. I'll concur with that.
Yeah.
Looks better.
Very true.
Looks better. Talks better.
All true. And she would tell you this.
Yeah, she would. She would. My experience also includes getting calls at 3 in the morning from Representative Barker when he was the president of the Portland Police Association, because I've represented numerous Portland police officers in various contexts, often involved in serious use of deadly force. My role on the committee was an odd one, especially because some people saw this committee as biased. I remember Mr. Foote, who's not here today, in a discussion said that this committee was sort of created to be aimed in my direction as a defense lawyer. And that just struck me as odd in the extreme, because when I look at the committee, I saw Chief Justice DeMunis, who was on, to my mind, the wrong side of the single most important decision by the Oregon Supreme Court, in which he dissented when other judges felt that Measure 11 was inappropriate in a particular case. That's Buck and Rodriguez. It has Jason Myers on the committee, the Marion County Sheriff, who calls Measure 11 a finely tuned sports car that's motoring along very well. It includes the Republican leader of the House, a state police officer for 25 years or more, a municipal prosecutor in Senator Prezansky, Representative Garrett, who some might call a big firm lawyer. I mean, there's
it's only worse than that.
The head of the corrections department, for goodness sakes. So, to my mind, it was not overwhelmingly designed to favor the defense side. And frankly, if it were up to me, there are a lot of changes that I would have made that would go far beyond what we have here. And I've had many cases that are sex abuse one, robbery two, the kinds of cases we're talking about. And I'd like to talk about some of those. And let's talk about the typical sex abuse one case, okay? And this is terrible conduct. This is touching another person for your own sexual gratification. Nobody says this is good conduct. But there are many, many of these cases in which everybody agrees, the district attorney and the defense, that a Measure 11 sentence is not appropriate. And I want you, and I see Mr. Underhill nodding his head, that's true. That is part of the Measure 11 process. And I want you to know, because I regret not expressing this in enough clarity when we would have some of our commission meetings. Well, some of these cases, the Multnomah County DAs used to call it a one-touch case. And what the defense role would be is to, in advocating for your client, in trying to convince the prosecutor not to charge this as a Measure 11 offense, we would have a psychosexual evaluation, which is to say we'd have a respected psychologist or psychiatrist. And this doesn't work if we get somebody who's just going to say whatever we want them to say. It only works if the defense uses somebody that's well respected by the state, so they'll see the report. We sometimes do a polygraph and say, look, the polygrapher also that you trust says this didn't happen but one time or two times or only to one person or whatever. And again, these are cases where assume the defendant confessed. So there's no defense. I know that a part of Measure 11 is the coercion of innocent people to plead guilty. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about guilty people and what the sentence should be. And so the mechanism for this What happens is, in this case that everybody believes Measure 11 is not appropriate, we present this information to the district attorney, and I'm not talking just about Mr. Underhill, there's many, many others. And what happens is, and by the way, we're talking to a deputy district attorney, often, especially in smaller counties, people with very little experience. And what we get is, well, okay, maybe Measure 11 is not appropriate. We'll let you plead guilty to an attempted sex abuse one. And by the way, one of my favorite slides in our commission's work was a PowerPoint slide that said, attempted crimes increased by over 400% after Measure 11 was enacted. And that doesn't mean that all of a sudden somehow criminals lost their nerve and they weren't completing the crime that they always used to attempt or think about. It's that the cases are reduced by the district attorney. And so the way that the mechanism for getting a judge to impose less than 75 months is the district attorney will say, well, okay, this is not a Measure 11 case. You can have an attempted Measure 11. And your client's got to take 57 months, or they'll pick a number. And we say, 57 months? Where'd you come up with that? And we're told, well, we have a committee that sits and talks about it, and we've run it by everybody else, and that's what people get in this county for this conduct. And we say, what's the data? We don't know the data. We don't get the data. They have the data. We don't have the data. And what it's like is, it's in some ways, if people have had the experience of buying a car from a maybe not the great car dealers that we're familiar with on our commission, Dick Withnell, I think Jackie may, Senator Winters may have some experience in the car business, but which I don't know what it is exactly. But it's like you're talking to somebody and you're saying, this guy's a good guy. Look at this report. Dr. Smith, a well-respected doctor, says it's never going to happen again or it shouldn't happen, et cetera, et cetera. And the deputy that we're talking to says, gee, Larry, that's great, but I did all I could do, and it's 57 months, or maybe, okay, 55 months. And so it's a extremely odd way for important matters of criminal justice to work. If this were the actual sentencing and you have a trial and the way that your defendant is going to get sentenced is everybody goes into a little room and they talk about what it is and you get to submit a written document, that's just not how it should work. There's no reason, it seems to me, why we... And the other thing is, there are few rooms in this country where there is one person who is elected by the voters and sitting on a high chair and is entrusted to make the most important decisions of our society. We have people, Judge Larson here, Judge Rosenblum. We have people who are the best people we have, and in our view, they should be the people making the decision on how long the sentence somebody is going to get. Because make no mistake about it, if you have a client who has confessed and who has done something wrong, and the offer is 57 months, there's very, very little that can be done to change that. The district attorney's office has essentially complete power to determine what the sentence is for these people. And that is, from the defense attorney's perspective, the most difficult aspect of Measure 11. And another thing I want to say is, I'm mystified every time I come here and other places. This isn't in my remarks, so it may not be very smooth. I'm mystified by the anecdotal approach to legislation. For every case where a killer was released early, we have cases where the prosecutors have prosecuted and convicted innocent people. Not Rod Underhill's office, but there are cases everywhere where that happens. And so it doesn't seem to me that one or two bad cases are such that we have to be in fear that we lock everybody up forever. It seems to me we have people who are entrusted to make the decisions and that the judges should make the decisions. I'm not saying I get to make the decisions. That would not be wise. Okay, the function of the prosecutor is much different than the function of the defense lawyer. And I know they take their job seriously. I have the utmost respect in Mr. Underhill and Mr. Foote as well. But it seems to me that, as Mr. Underhill just said, judges know how to give bad people bad sentences. They can give consecutive sentences. There are ways that bad people are going to get bad sentences. This way, we simply allow the judge instead of the DA to give people that everybody thinks shouldn't get a Measure 11 sentence an appropriate sentence.
Thank you.
Co-chairs Olson, Garrett, Winters, and Prozanski, and members of the committee, thank you.
My name is Darrell Larson, and I'm a senior judge, as mentioned, retired in 2007 from Lane County Circuit Court bench. And since that time, I've been the chair of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, and I appear here today on behalf of the commission. My background essentially was that I was a prosecutor for just short of 19 years, and I was a trial court judge for 17 years, and then did Plan B after that for 5 years. I don't want my comments today to be taken as bashing of DAs or defense lawyers, for that matter. I think anybody who's been involved in the real world and down in the pits with these kinds of cases realizes how incredibly difficult these situations are. But I think I can give you some clarity about the process of thinking your way through some of the decisions you're going to be asked to make, both politically and practically. I think we can all start by saying that the entire American justice system of jurisprudence is built on the concept that the surest path to true justice is a balanced adversarial process where we have skilled advocate lawyers on both sides of the case making the best case they can make to an independent magistrate who is beholden to no one except Lady Justice. And making those fair decisions, of course, sometimes involving a jury in terms of fact-finding, along with the judge making decisions about the law. When that model is allowed to work as designed, while not infallible, it's better than any other system of justice that's come to the mind of man. And it's particularly, I think, even better in this country because we have levels of appellate review that can look at what happened down below and make decisions about whether or not it was done in accordance with the law and sufficient facts to justify the verdict. In criminal cases, we have adversaries on both sides, the prosecutor representing the executive branch and the government. We have a defense attorney representing the defendant. And when the people of Oregon adopted the mandatory minimum sentencing scheme we referred to as Measure 11 for many serious felonies, our time-honored and tested model of American jurisprudence began to be skewed, shifting decision-making power from one advocate to one advocate, I should say, as mentioned by Mr. Matisar, and away from a balanced, independent approach so that an independent judicial position can make decisions after hearing everything on both sides of the case. There is more to this proposed legislation than just cost savings or reinvestment of money that can be diverted from prison costs back to the communities to try to do a better job and give both of these fellows that are on either side of me a chance to really get better outcomes with the offenders that go through their counties. There is a measure of restoring fair and impartial justice that is at stake here. One particular personal experience of mine from the real world may be instructive. However, first I want to suggest to you that the Public Safety Commission's recommendations only very minimally nip at the very edges of just three Measure 11 crimes, but they do result in not only significant potential savings from prison costs, but restore some of our time-honored system of fairness in our justice system while still improving public safety. Now for the example that I mentioned. The last week I was on the bench, and this may have just been fate for the rest of my life to use as an example, I don't know, but it happened the last week I was on the bench, and I think it was a Monday or a Tuesday. I received a case that was sent over to me from the presiding judge to see if I could engage the parties in a rational settlement of the case. It involved a charge of first-degree rape involving a 38-year-old man and a longtime girlfriend. The defendant had a 20-year supervisory position that he'd held with a major company in Eugene, was a longtime respected employee of that company. And his only thing on his entire adult record since age 18 was one speeding ticket. However, he had one prior adjudication in juvenile court when he was 17-year-old for engaging in a sexual behavior with a 14-year-old, almost 15-year-old girlfriend. And he got in trouble for that. It was apparent to me, and I think to the parties, that this particular defendant was not a serious threat to the public in any way, shape, or form, that he was a longtime taxpayer and in all other spheres of his life had been a good and upstanding citizen. After considerable discussion, the prosecutor in the case finally offered a plea to a non-Major 11 crime with a sentence of a year in the county jail with the potential of work release so this fellow would hopefully keep his job and continue to be a productive citizen and not be a burden to the taxpayers. The defendant, to my amazement, said, no, I did not do this crime. I'm not going to plead guilty, even if I end up with 75 months as a mandatory minimum under Measure 11. I left the room concerned, as did his attorney, and I think even the DA. The day of trial, Friday of the very last day I was on the bench in Lane County, the district attorney came to me and said, I dismissed that case this morning. And I said, why? He said, because this morning a girlfriend of the victim called us and said she had had a conversation with the victim on the phone the night before, which she tape recorded, in which the victim admitted that she was just making this up because she thought the guy was cheating on her and she was going to get even with him. I suggest to you that not many people under these kinds of pressures and circumstances have the wherewithal and commitment to stick to their principles and risk 75 months of their life, or oftentimes far more. And with all due respect to both of these gentlemen, there are lots of cases that come in across our desks where there are multiple allegations of sex abuse, one, period. And those are very difficult cases. I mean, Rod's had lots of those, and I know I had lots of those. I prosecuted sex cases for a long time, and I'm sure Larry has as well. It is very difficult in those kinds of cases to really always determine exactly what it was that happened. Oftentimes, by the very nature of, and I use this particular charge as an example, those particular charges are very difficult because there's lots of family intrigue involved lots of times. There may be all kinds of things that are going on interpersonally where there are motivations that may or may not be involved in the case. It may or may not be true. The very nature of the crime is one that takes place in private, and because it's sexual touching, it's not usually beyond that. There may be no other evidence in the case, and so it basically is who believes whom. I would suggest to you, just as an example with respect to sex abuse in the first degree, that is a very poor setting for one side in the equation of our justice system to have unlimited power to drive the bargain. And my example of the case that I had that last week in office is an example of that kind of misplaced power within the system. It unbalances the system. You can rest assured, as we all can, that there are people serving time in long periods of time in Oregon prisons right now who did not in fact commit a crime that they were charged with. They pled guilty and they got an agreed sentence, but they did it under the duress that arises in the system that we've got under Measure 11. I want you to understand that this legislation is not a frontal assault on Measure 11. It nips only at three specific crimes that happen to have some substantial impact. Mr. Underhill is absolutely right. They make up a disproportionate number of the sentences that go to the state penitentiary. And when you look at the time actually spent at the penitentiary, it's not just a matter of intakes. It's a matter of how much time do those people get in those intakes. They are a disproportionately represented amount of time and cost to the public taxpayers. If we can do something about these particular three crimes, you can have a major impact upon cost savings to the public. And if you can do it in a way that not only improves justice, but improves the rest of Oregon's offenders because there is more money to do a better job with them to make the people safer, then that is a sensible decision. I want to suggest to you today that no legislator in Oregon, regardless of party affiliation or ideological stripe, should have the slightest hesitancy of very marginally tinkering with these three crimes in Measure 11, because what you do will not only have the effect of making Oregon safer and saving some money and distributing it in a more sensible fashion, but will begin restoring at least a measure of justice, and I mean real justice under the true traditional American model of jurisprudence, back into our system. That is something that every one of you can be proud about. I want to thank you for the time you've given us here today.
Representative Barker.
Thank you. A few sessions back, I approached somebody about changing sex abuse one, and they said, no, unless you change all of Measure 11, we're not interested. I mean, he wasn't speaking for anybody but himself, I would assume, but there are advocates, I consider myself a pretty strong supporter of Measure 11, who would be willing to take a look at some of those things, but was unable to do that. But one of the things I would like to I just did a quick pencil here. So we change that, and so you can plead down to 16 to 18 months. Somebody gets 18 months or 16 months, 30%, they're down to 14 months, 3 months out early, so they've served 11 months for what maybe is pretty serious sex crime. So I have grave concerns about that. But I would also like to ask maybe one you could answer. It's my understanding under 1049, about half of those cases are not taken out of Measure 11, allowed to plead to 1049. And if one of you could talk about, it was in 1997, 1049 came into effect, which allowed modification of robbery 2, assault 2, and kidnap 2. And then in 2001, there was House Bill 2379, which modified sex abuse one, rape two, penetration, unlawful penetration to sodomy two. So they have been some of those things.
Talk about the first part of that.
Talk about anybody. Talk about anything. Please.
As far as the 12 or 13 months for Measure 11 offense, remember now there are people that get probation for Measure 11 offense.
Yeah.
There are people who, because the district attorney believes that they don't deserve 75 months, and they agree one way or another, they get probation. So this new the legislation would allow that, just as it's allowed now. It would allow the judge to do it, not the district attorney to do it. The other thing is, the serious sex abuse cases, the cases that Mr. Underhill indicated were the multiple victims in multiple situations, the judge has the power to make them be consecutive sentences. So it is not at all the situation that every Measure 11 sex abuse, what is now a Measure 11 sex abuse, would turn into somebody getting 13 months. It would only be what all sides see is the most lenient one, and which happens now anyway. Again, though, the judge would make the decision, not the district attorney.
You know, I'll launch into 1049, otherwise known as ORS 137712, here in a moment. What a lot of what I'm hearing, but it might be my ears only, is that your criminal justice system is working. What you've heard a lot about is when we have a situation that calls for something other than a ballot Measure 11 70-month, or in the situation of sex abuse in the first degree, 75 months remedy, when we have a situation that calls for something other than that, your criminal justice system is doing that. You've heard it from Mr. Matizar. You're hearing it. I'm agreeing with him. When he was speaking, I was nodding. We have those cases, a not insignificant number, where reaching an appropriate resolution other than 75 months is the remedy and the appropriate way to go. The point I want to make and weave it into your question, Representative Barker, is when we're talking about changing the sex abuse one, rob twos, and assault twos, those people that are doing those 70-month and 75, those people who we've chosen to not do what has been talked about, but instead, no, this person actually committed a rape, will allow them to plead to a sex abuse in the first degree. We're not going to draw, I mean, prosecutors are not going to come all the way down to 16, 18 months when they did a rape. It's not going to happen.
We're not going to see the savings is the point I'm trying to make. Now, 1049, Senate Bill 1049 ORS 137712.
Do you want to say something?
No, you can finish.
Okay. Supported by district attorneys profoundly. I personally support it. 1049, even though nobody listened to me back in those late 90s, I was just one of the worker guys, right? But it was an appropriate vehicle for some of the cases that we're talking about. It allows, under certain circumstances, somebody charged with assault in the second degree, for us to do just what we're talking about doing and still have them plead not to an attempt, but to the completed crime. And under those circumstances, move over to the gridlock and find ourselves in the gridlock formula and impose a gridlock term consistent with lots of rules that are found within that sentencing scheme. It was enacted in the late 90s. It exists today. We use it not uncommonly. It exists for robbery in the second degree. Likewise, used not uncommonly when appropriate. So we're doing, in summary, we're doing what we think you want to do, want us, from a public safety standpoint, to do. We have the tools and vehicles to do it with. They exist today. The change that is being suggested to Measure 11 with these three offenses, I do not feel will realize you the cost-saving benefit that you are seeking. Whether you want to, you know, money being one thing, philosophy, a philosophical choice being another, I'm separating the two. I think you've generally feel know where I come from personally on the philosophical, that is we're sentencing the right people. But I get it that there's can be disagreement there for sure.
Senator Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, this is fascinating. I think we're all fascinated by what you've presented. And you're all very distinguished. However, I feel I need to just point out a few things on behalf of the taxpayers. I remember in the mid-80s when the petitions were going around for Measure 11, and it was put on the ballot. And these were good, decent, upstanding people in the community I was in. And they had just had it with people like LaDon Stevens getting strict sentences and then being released and being released by judges. And the opinion of judges wasn't very high in those days, as I remember it. And you're still seeing this across the country where there isn't Measure 11. You're seeing judges, you see it on certain news programs where judges let people out and the public can't understand why. So, you know, for me to take the step to overturn the voters, which would be a huge step, I would have to know that there's some kind of control on judges who are doing those types of activities. We have ethics commissions for all kinds of professional groups, doctors, dentists, naturopaths, attorneys, but I don't see anybody holding judges accountable. Maybe you have such a group, but seems to me we can't just be silent when those kinds of sentences are just ignored. So I'd like you to address, I would like the judge to address that.
Let the judge go first.
Well,
if you don't mind, I think we're, you know, I'd kind of like to stay a little bit more in the conversation where you're at. I mean,
I'm going to stay in that.
Okay.
I think that when you come down, in terms of how Measure 11 actually works in the real world, what you come down to is are decisions on criminal cases too important to be left to an elected judge to make? That seems to me to be a very bad argument for Americans to be making. And that's where we get left. Once again, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I was a prosecutor back in the 80s, and I was more than a little chagrined about going to court and having somebody that was a danger to the public get 3 years and then be out in no time flat and have to prosecute him again for something worse. I mean, that is the real world as well. There was a time when the sentences were unrealistically, ridiculously low, and we didn't spend, but we had a tiny fraction of the prison capacity that we've got now. That's changed a lot since Measure 11. What we're trying to do in this legislation is get to a reasonable cap of about 14,000 people and figuring out some way to realistically do that given the things that have happened in the meantime. One of the things that has happened in the meantime is that back in the 80s and 90s when, you know, Rod and I were working in DA's offices in Portland, Eugene, frankly, people didn't know what worked. They didn't know why people did what they did. They didn't know how to get it to change. The research on that has dramatically shifted over the years. I mean, we do know a lot more about how to actually make an impact with a lot of offenders, and happily, some of the people that are considered high or medium risk are the ones that a lot of those programs work the best with. So there is real opportunity here if we can invest the money and figure out a way to do it. I simply suggest to you that this legislation does a pretty good job of getting you the opportunity to make some reinvestment here. And with respect to the Measure 11 offenses, I think you don't have to lose too much sleep over the fact that people who really deserve to get serious time are going to still get it. But it does provide an opportunity for judges to be back into the equation of American justice, which is what our whole system is based on in the first place. So I, for one, even when I was on the other side of the table, felt like a judge is the right person to be making an independent decision. If I can't do a good enough job of making the argument to convince a fair-minded judge that I'm right, then I should lose, or I should not get what I'm being asked to do, or asked me to, excuse me. And I still believe that. I believe it after having been a judge. So I think judges, by and large, try to make the best possible decision they can make. And are they responsible? Yes, as much as you are. We're elected as well. So if we don't do a very good job, it's going to be on the front page, and somebody's going to kick us out of office. So is it immediate? No, it isn't. But it is effective.
Thank you.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For Mr. Underhill, particularly, focusing on the 85% or so of ballot Measure 11 cases that plead out, who in your office makes the ultimate decision on prison-bound plea offers? Right. And in your opinion, is the system used in your office generally the one used throughout DA's offices in the state of Oregon?
Thank you, Representative Hicks.
Pardon me. Well, I'll start with my office. I'm certainly most comfortable with knowing how that operates. It is an operation that I inherited more than created. I'll add to it that as a kind of a boots-on-the-ground prosecutor for that 20 years or so that I worked, and then the next five as a chief deputy, I helped Mr. Shrunk fine-tune it, but then made no modifications to that vehicle, so to speak, of how we review ballot Measure 11 cases in the office. Or I'll add any determinate sentence. So that includes Measure 57 as well. So here's how we do it. I'll try and make it simple. If it's a homicide-involved matter, I am the final decider. I will review any offer that goes out of the door, and I'll review any offer that is received in the door, and I'll be the final person. Now, of course, I am taking into consideration my lead prosecutor's opinion and their chief deputy. Sometimes it's the same person. But in the hierarchy of things, I have three chief deputies and a first assistant, all part of management, very experienced people. I, of course, am going to listen to the desires of the crime victim and those people directly affected. In, I will say, almost every single one of those cases, we've had judicial involvement as well. We call them JSCs, Judicial Settlements Conference. And so we're going to weigh all of the factors, and I will make the final decision if it's a homicide-involved matter. In the ballot Measure 11 determinate sentence non-homicide cases, we have units within our office. I'll summarize. For example, domestic violence unit, child abuse unit, gang unit. So I have a number. I have the luxury of having a number of, by and large, experts in each of those fields. If it's a domestic violence ballot Measure 11 case that we're referring or talking about, my domestic violence unit members that handle those felony level cases will meet with their chief deputy, who is also in the case that I have right now. She spent 27 years in the office, 20 supervising the child abuse unit. Charlene Woods is her name. She will review in that group setting that determinate sentence fact pattern, the judicial settlement conference offers that we've done in the past. We'll relate it to situations that resemble, to the extent they do, other cases that we've had. We will talk about the judicial settlement conference that has either occurred or will occur, because in almost every situation that we're talking about a determinate sentence, Multnomah County engages in a judicial settlement conference. We have judges involved in helping us to reach an appropriate resolution. The chief deputy, I turn over to the chief deputies the final word on the non-homicide. They must approve or disapprove of any offer that's going out the door or being received in this office on a determinate sentence. Just to touch on it, when we're talking about a gang-involved matter, Chuck Sparks is my chief deputy. Over 25 years of experience as a prosecutor. When we're talking about other violent crimes unit, Don Reese, close to 20 years of experience as a chief deputy. No individual prosecutor, unless they're a chief deputy, no individual prosecutor is allowed to release a proposed resolution on a Measure 11 case or a Measure 57 case without that level of scrutiny. Is that a practice that's followed in the 36 counties throughout our state? I can't say that I know. I think that anecdotally, I can say that a number do follow that generalized practice, but I haven't deeply done the research on that.
Thank you. One more?
Yeah, I would like to wind this up by 7:30 if we can, so if it's short, okay. And then I've got Representative Garrett wants to say.
If I could just respond for a second. I think Mr. Underhill got to the real nub of the issue when he said that we have judges helping us make the appropriate decision. That's what Oregon's sentencing system is. They have judges helping the prosecutor make the appropriate decision. In my view, the way the system should work is everything should be the same as it is now. They have these meetings. It's valued. It's important. And then they make a recommendation. Judges follow prosecutorial recommendations a large number of the time in everything from release decisions to sentencing to motions to everything. They follow the recommendations. Let them do this work. Say to the judge, Judge, we staffed it. This is what's fair. This is why we think it's fair. But let the defense also say, call witnesses, make arguments to the ultimate decision maker, and then let the judge make the decision. You know, also,
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'll stay away from the philosophy of this kind of sentencing, although I'd love to talk about it. But I have a very specific concern about we might be confused on a factual question, and we might want to get Mr. Prinz back up, because I want to address Mr. Underhill's argument that we're not going to actually get the savings because prosecutors are not going to plea down a rape case to an 18-month sentence. I believe you.
Right.
And I don't believe that the bill assumes you will do that. As I understand it, the projected savings are modeled on cases where Rob 2, Assault 2, and Sex Abuse 1 were, in fact, the most serious offenses in the indictment. And if that's the case, I don't think your concern is applicable. So I would actually just like Mr. Prinz to come up, and if I'm wrong, let's correct it now. But I think that needs to be straightened out.
Co-chairs, Representative Garrett, thank you for that. And just to clarify,
ID.
For the record, my name is Craig Prinz. What Rod is mentioning, where there's an higher level case, like say there was a rape one or an unlawful sexual penetration, we knew that we should not model any savings on that kind of case. So we only looked at cases where these three crimes, Rob 2, Assault 2, Sex Abuse in the First Degree, were the most serious crime in the indictment. And that's what the savings is modeled off of. When you look at those three crimes where they are the most serious conviction, that's 18% of all the months imposed in 2012. So I agree with Rod, you would not see a savings in a case where there's a higher mandatory minimum. And that's not what we modeled. We modeled only the impact where these are the most serious offenses in the indictment. I hope that clarifies that.
Appreciate that. Thanks for clarifying that, too.
Okay, well, Zansky.
I'll talk with Mr. Prins about what he just said, because I've got follow-up questions surrounding that, because it's less than clear, and it's well, I'll leave it at that, only because it's not insignificant. But I'm curious as to when he says the 18%, it's for you, not me, to follow up with him if you have questions about what he had just said, I suppose.
Go ahead.
Thank you. So first let me just put a statement out here, because we have a lot of discussions going on as to what 3194 really isn't. It doesn't propose to overturn or throw out Measure 11. There's 22 different crimes that are placed there by either citizen initiative or by the legislature. The proposal only deals with three of those offenses. Those three offenses have already been modified by the legislature, just like Representative Barker had said. And we actually had agreements from various groups that are interested parties that are at the dais now as to making these changes. So the proposal is really just to get us back as to the duty of who's going to make the appropriate length of sentence, and that's really to the court restoring, as Judge Larson says, judicial discretion. Now, we passed as a state Measure 11 in November of 94, went in effect, I believe, April or May of 95. So we've got about 18 years where we've shifted that power that was at the court for the judge to make, and it's now gone to this other part. And I guess the part that I keep on hearing and seeing is how it has matured over those years to what we now have as to being impacts as decisions that are being made and the offers that are coming. And Rod, I guess one of the things I've heard and what I've seen is that many offers that are now coming on these type of cases where you are offering a lesser sentence, or say the DAs are offering a lesser sentence, if it's a juvenile case, they're being required to waive their right to second look. In some cases, waiving other type of appeals, or not being able to participate in various prison programs. So it just seems like we're shifting away where an individual who can potentially, let's say, have their life turned around and have modifications occur once they are inside the system, basically made or determined before they even get in the system. And that just seems like we've shifted the power to that part. So why is it that we don't allow for the court to actually make these determinations? And why is it that we need to preempt someone before they even get in the system, knowing evidence-based practices, knowing that there's programs that can actually benefit us as society?
So I think about a three-part question, so I'll try to take them off one at a time. One of the notions is we've developed, as you've said, and I think I've heard a few different places, it falls more in the category of philosophy than cost savings, this notion of taking the judicial discretion away. One of the best ways to gauge whether judicial discretion has been, the shift has occurred, is to look at, do we see a change in people exercising their right to a trial? Prior to Measure 11, we saw about a 16% exercise of a right to trial in these Measure 11 related cases. In 2011, the Criminal Justice Commission, Craig Prinz's office, conducted a study. It's exactly the same. The same number of people that are choosing to have a trial before Measure 11 are choosing to have a trial now. Contrast that with the federal system, where the federal system has about a 3% trial rate. Why is there a 3% trial rate and a much larger percent trial rate in the state system? A bit debatable, right? But some argue that the weight of the sentence in the federal system dictates plea negotiations and chills the right to take advantage of a trial. That's one argument that I've heard numerous times. But when we take that back to our state and look at our pre- and post-Measure 11 trial rates, they're the same. People are taking advantage of trials as they should. Your other part of your question, Senator Przanski, dealt with the second look and juvenile offenders. Interesting, you know, I'm very interested in that issue. One of the first things I did in office was asked one of my chief deputies, Charlene Woods, you've heard me refer to it before, to do some research into revisiting our considered use, once again, of the second look option. Now, to put that in context, what the heck's that prosecutor guy talking about? And the answer is, second look has been around as long as Measure 11. And out of the gate, so to speak, I and many members in my office participated in second look hearings. I've done a number of them. What are they in a nutshell? And they are, and I'll just use some round numbers. Let's say that a juvenile offender was given 60 months, and at 30 months into that term, OYA, the Oregon Youth Authority, would conduct a report on how well they're doing or not, right? But they'll assess how things are going. They'll submit that to the court. The prosecutor will have a hearing relative with the defense, of course, involved. Oftentimes, we would stipulate that this person is somebody that we will is doing well in that setting, and the sentence will be reduced, effectively in half, but not quite, but effectively in half. Why is that a practice that's being used less today than it was back in, say, 1998, 1999? And the answer is an evolution of some thinking, an evolution of some concerns, to be candid. I'll restate that I have asked one of my chief deputies to re-explore this issue because I would like to see if that's a vehicle that we should use again like we did in the late 90s. Here's why we didn't in the decade of the 2000s, so to speak. Quite candidly, the product, the report that we were getting, and that we were taking to the second look hearings, we believe we were not as thorough, as complete as they should be in this important area. We found over the course of time, I don't know where the fault lies, whose it is, or whether we're just perceive it wrong. I don't know. But as an office, and I've spoke with John Foote, I've spoke with Bob Herman, they saw the same things and have moved away from second look hearings for the same reason, and that is we unfortunately less and less could not rely on the quality of that that report that was coming out so that we could go to a hearing and rely on that being a good process for review. So instead, what did we do? So what we did is we modified our pretrial offers at the front end. Instead of the 60-month, in my example, that would have existed, say, in 1998, that became 48. That became 36. No, and we would include language, no second look, right? So we made reductions at the front end of the resolution and then denied the option for second look. Is it the right way to go in every single situation? Senator, I don't know that it was the right way to go in every situation. It was shared by all of us practitioners at the senior deputy level and higher in the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office that was the way to go because of what I've summarized. Am I interested in revisiting that? Does my chief deputy have a meeting with Mr. O'Leary from OYA? Frankly, I think they met today. She mentioned yesterday to me that she was meeting with him today to do just what I've mentioned, to revisit and see if we can change what I've summarized.
Okay.
Quickly.
Senator Winters.
Judge Larson talked about balance. And balance in our our system, our system of justice. And I just listened about second look. And it just struck me, because in listening to about balance, that what we're talking about is one entity of our system having all the control. And that was kind of talking about second look, the decision not to or to go forward, and where are checks and balances? Because always it has been about checks and balances, recognizing even in this process of 90 of us that not one of us is imperial enough to know everything, nor to be able to say that what I say is where we should be, or what Andy says where we should be. But collectively, through all that, we develop a balance. And so I think, you know, we're talking about what has happened. We have shifted somehow our whole concept of what we have believed for years. And I sit here, and if I'm John Q. Public out there, and I'm wondering if John Q. Public, not understanding the shift that we have made, they may have understood that we said we wanted to be tougher on crime. They may have understood that we wanted everybody to be more accountable. But I don't think that they understood this actual shift of power that had occurred in our system. I would like to have a comment from the three of you as to whether we have actually, the people who rely on what we do, what you do, to make certain that we are balanced. And as I thought about what you say, that the individuals in the DA's office and those deputies, and my thought goes to, why do we have a disproportionate number inside of our institutions? If I do an analysis of the length of stay, I have a much longer length of stay for individuals who are of the minority class than I do others. Now, somehow, there's an imbalance. And so I'm trying to wrap my arms around, how can we fix an imbalance?
If
and we asked for a letter later, but it just kind of struck me when you talked about second look.
Anyways, if we just wrap it up then with that sentence, with that question, if each of you could take and limit yourself if you could. I know that's going to be difficult. You know, a minute, 2 minutes each. I appreciate that. Thank you.
I can start.
Okay, Judge Larson, go ahead.
I'll be really brief. You know, I think Rod absolutely hit it right on the head when he started by talking about his brother. 100 chances for his brother is good from Rod's point of view, and I totally, absolutely sympathize with that. And the truth of the matter is, as a prosecutor, having been a prosecutor, I can think of lots of examples where people came to me and said, you know, but this is my son. I didn't know he was X amount of time. Well, everybody feels that way. I mean, if you have a family, everybody feels that way. And so that is exactly why we need to have judges involved in this process. You know, there is no independent arbiter between those two adversarial sides if one side has all the power to drive the bargain. There is a miscarriage of justice that's unfair to the district attorneys, and it's unfair to the public, and it's unfair to the defendant. What I'm saying here is that the commission, it seems to me, made a conscious decision not to take on Measure 11, period. But in looking at places where money could be saved and still keep the public safe, and in fact actually probably even make it safer, by diverting some money from prison savings that will happen in the future if we look at specific crimes, you have to look at some of Measure 11. The three crimes that drive that prison population are the three that are involved: sex abuse 1, robbery 2, and assault 2. And that gives us one more opportunity, gives you one more opportunity to actually get judges back involved in the system of justice, making the decisions they get paid to make. It should not be a system where district attorneys can't participate in second look because OYA, you know, they just aren't capable of doing a good enough job. Judges shouldn't be involved in making a decision because they just aren't capable of doing a good enough job. Doesn't that process sort of loudly say, we got a problem here? I mean, it does to me as a citizen, and I hope it does to you.
So I'll go next. When ballot measure 11 was passed, 67% of the citizens passed that initiative. There was an effort to repeal it. 75% voted against its repealing. Were they confused by the things we've been talking about? I don't know. You know, we'd have to get in the hearts and minds of each individual. I don't know whether they're confused. What it does tell us is they want to be safe in their homes. It was a social contract where I started. Who is, it takes all of us. It takes Mr. Matizar. It takes Judge Larson. It takes the prosecutors of the world to have that balance and to reach an appropriate resolution. I described to Representative Hicks the rigor that every determinate sentence goes through in the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. When I say rigor, I mean it. It is sometimes to the great frustration to the individual prosecutor that they've got to, go to so many meetings and discuss one case and not have the freedom themselves. They at times get frustrated. In spite of that frustration, it is a tried, tested, true vehicle for internal ideas that are vetted with, and I just, Senator Winters, I want to emphasize this. I think it's accurate to say that almost every determinative sentence that occurs in Multnomah County has been vetted by a judge. They are reviewing it, sparring with us when appropriate. And when we don't hit the nail on the head for a resolution that's appropriate, Mr. Matizar says, call a jury. And that's the way that should be. We need to, when we look at our trial rate, when we look at our length of stays and incarceration rates, first length of stay, Multnomah County is an average of 33 months per admittee in the state penitentiary system. The national average, 59 months from comparing 2006 study, which was the last one. Part of this is me getting to, while we do wield some serious business done by serious people, administering, what we hope to be a fair and balanced public safety system, it is very important. We take it very seriously. And I think when you look at the data regarding who goes and for how long, and you compare us to other jurisdictions, which is one mile marker to do it, as you've heard, I know, the commissioner's heard, Oregon is a leader in the country in how we do business in a public safety continuum. Thank you.
Larry?
Let me just say that the judicial assistance in these judicial settlement conferences is of a very minor sort. Everybody knows in these things that the DA has the power. The judge sits there, makes suggestions, but it is not in any sense a judicial function that the judge has in these hearings. Second of all, calling a jury doesn't help in the cases that I'm talking about. When you've got somebody who's confessed to a 75-month sentence, everybody agrees he shouldn't get 75 months, the DA offers 57, calling a jury doesn't help. I mean, he's going to get 75 or 57. There's really nothing you could do at all in that circumstance. And finally, my memory of the Measure 11 debate, such as it was, and I was, of course, here for that. I've been here practicing law since 1974, was not that it was people unhappy with the judges. It was really a truth in sentencing problem. I had client after client who'd commit what now would be a minor residential burglary, and the judge would sentence that person to 20 years, impose 20 years. But everybody knew that wasn't 20 years because of the parole board that would let people out because the prisons couldn't handle the 20 years. So I don't think it's necessary to look at the Measure 11 situation as people unhappy with the judges. It was just a system that was messed up in many ways. So,
right.
Thank you.
Well, I want to thank all of you. A great conversation on a very serious, important topic, and I appreciate all the attention that we've been getting.
Thank you very much. Committee, we're adjourned.